Today, property signs for the 5th of July 2021. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of this post covering funds and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In today's show, we look at mortgage stress, international property buyers, the ACT stamp duty changes, and the latest on low interest rates. And also, we'll look at the latest proposals to share information via open banking with financial advisors, financial planners, and mortgage brokers. But first, loan stress may soon trigger a response from Australian regulators, according to a new report from Moody's Analytics. The report warns of an environment in which credit growth is outstripping income growth. Moody's warned such an environment is ultimately unsustainable and will likely trigger a response from financial regulators. Moody's Analytics estimate that 20% of Australia's population is under mortgage stress, which they define as paying 30% or more of household income in mortgage payments. That's an issue when lending rates are at historic lows. An underlying concern, said Moody's, is that when interest rates do eventually rise, highly leveraged households need to be able to continue servicing their loans, even if rate increases are forecast to be gradual, Katrina L, senior economist at Moody's, said. L believes that the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority is on the verge of stepping in to cool the red-hot housing market. APRA has previously intervened to calm investor demand for housing. Macroprudential tools are particularly useful with sustained low interest rates because they can target pockets of concern, Al said. And I will just make the point that I don't define mortgage stress the same way as Moody's has done. I look at cash flow, and if you want to know more about that, come along for my live show to Tuesday at 8 p.m. Sydney time, where I'll go through the latest mortgage stress data. The problem with the random 30% number is that it really doesn't account for the differences between different households. Some can afford a lot more of their income going on mortgage repayments, others less, which is why I calculate mortgage stress based on real cash flow coming in and money going out. And I think that's a much better way. And by the way, if you run that calculation, then the level of mortgage stress is way a lot higher than Moody's is suggesting. But I also agree with them that even small incremental movements from this point could be very adverse for many households. Next, I did some modelling for ABC last week, which was actually featured on the news and also on The Business. And it showed that there has been a switch in the main geographies, with a notable fall from Asia, including China, the commensurate rise from Europe and America, and a rise in property purchases from returning residents. As Domain says, international residents are keen to move to Australia and are making plans to move to major capital cities here, even though it may take more than a year for them to get into the country due to closed borders, according to agents. The keen interest comes despite Northern Hemisphere countries reaching higher vaccination rates and reopening their economies, while millions of Australians have been living under lockdowns to stamp out early-stage COVID-19 outbreaks. Australia is still seen as an attractive destination, with the latest Foreign Investment Review Board report finding 7,056 residential real estate applications were approved in the financial year 2019-20. That was a drop in approvals of 455 from the year before, but the value of investments totaled $17.1 billion, which is an increase of $2.3 billion from the prior year. A year later, interest is strong. Sydney Sotheby's International Realtor Director, Michael Pillar, said he was up early every day answering queries about properties from overseas-based buyers. It's been great, and it's kept me up between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. every morning, Mr. Pillar said. A lot of my clients, their family members, are already here, or they have children studying here, and they dream of having a residence here and coming to Australia. A lot of expats still want to come back too. Along the Gold Coast and other popular holiday spots close to Brisbane, which have seen a rush of in-state buyers looking for a better lifestyle during the pandemic, foreign buyers have been looking at prestige properties. Koloshi Managing Director Michael Koloshi said he was fielding many inquiries from overseas buyers, including expats. It comes in waves, and it's driven by certain types of stock, he said. If we're launching a property price between $5 million and $15 million, they're getting a lot of strong inquiries from overseas buyers. Domain senior research analyst Nicola Powell said the latest rise in international investment was due to a range of factors, including Australia's booming house prices and being seen as a relatively safe haven from the coronavirus pandemic. Australia's house prices rose by 5.7% in the March quarter, with a record annual median of $899,509 across all capital cities, seeing some expected price gains after the coronavirus hit. That rise in foreign investment spending was likely due to some extraordinary growth in prices compared to 2018-19, when the property market was in a downturn, Dr. Powell said. But also the types of houses being purchased by foreign buyers are bigger and more elite. Dr. Powell said people were becoming more relaxed about taking a risk and buying a property in Australia sight unseen, with the chance to move to a country has had far fewer cases of the coronavirus. Australia is very attractive for people looking to relocate and even students preparing for study when you throw in the health dynamic, she said. While foreign property buyers are paying more for properties in Australia, they're also covering the extra costs of stamp duty and other taxes charged to buyers who are not Australian citizens. The FIRB data showed the number of properties sitting vacant for more than 6 months in a 12-month period, had almost doubled from 118 properties in 2018-19 to 231 last year. This meant buyers could be faced with vacancy fees, which in 2019-20 totaled $3.7 million, the report showed. A lot of these homes that are vacant were purchased before COVID-19 hit and before we closed the borders, Bell Property Boulder and director and auctioneer Robert Ding said. They're now caught overseas and can't get back, so there's little they can do. Some buyers are looking to get around such fees by gaining their permanent residency before buying in Australia. Some have been renting in Melbourne for 4 or 5 years, gaining their permanent residency and then buying a property without the need for FIRB approval, Mr. Ding said. Lots of new migrants will rent first and then buy once they have their permanent residency because they save on additional stamp duty, he said. And talking of stamp duty, the ACT government has scrapped stamp duty for off-the-plan purchases of up to $500,000 as part of its tax reform agenda. From 1 July 21, all buyers signing off-the-plan contracts of purchases up to $500,000 will not have to pay a cent of stamp duty. The change represents a saving of around $10,360 for a new apartment or townhouse valued at $500,000. But previous stamp duty concessions of $11,400 for owner-occupiers buying off-the-plan units valued between $500,000 and $750,000 no longer apply. ACT Chief Minister Andrew Barr said the move would help increase the supply of affordable housing across Canberra. The ACT has been leading the country in removing inefficient taxes that significantly increase the cost of buying a home, Mr. Barr said. Since 2012, we've been reducing stamp duty in the territory, and this will continue throughout this term of government. Our priority through the next phase of stamp duty reductions is to focus on the most affordable end of the housing market. This is a further step in our tax reform program and one that encourages an increased supply of housing below the $500,000 threshold. Mr. Barr said that if the government had not started the reforms in 2012, buyers would have been paying more than $20,000 in stamp duty for a $500,000 home. Just across the border in New South Wales, home buyers are paying up to $17,707 in stamp duty for such a property, he said. By abolishing inefficient taxes such as stamp duty and replacing this revenue with our fairest and most effective tax base, we are increasing economic activity in the ACT and supporting housing affordability. Emma Baker from Installa Estate Agents said that there had been an influx of owner-occupiers signing off the planned contracts in recent weeks, keen to capitalise on the stamp duty concession for more expensive apartments and townhouses. We've seen a huge push over the last 3 weeks for people making the final decision to purchase and receive that stamp duty concession, Ms. Barker said. She expected the decision to act stamp duty for off-the-plan homes under $500,000 would attract. I am genuinely really excited to see what happens because the stamp duty concessions were for established owners, not just first home buyers. So I'm predicting we'll see a bit of a drop off in the off the plan market with owner occupiers that will be replaced by investors who are getting their confidence back, she said. Off the plan had been very, very strong recently. COVID has meant the established market has been insane too. But the movements we've seen in the off the plan is nothing like I've ever seen before. Economists expect Tuesday's Reserve Bank board meeting to acknowledge the economy's surprisingly strong recovery and to signal some tapering of its $200 billion plus quantitative easing monetary stimulus. As hopes rise for lockdown-stricken Greater Sydney, with a decrease in new coronavirus cases in the state to 16 on Sunday from 35 on Saturday, confidence is rising that the toll on economic activity will not hold back the broad direction of the recovery. The majority of forecasters in the Australian Financial Review's June quarter survey of economists do not think the Reserve Bank will lift the cash rate from its 0.1% level at least until 2023, but most expect the central bank will begin to lighten its other monetary tools, the preconditions for a future rate rise. The simple fact is that the RBA has significantly underestimated the strength of the economic recovery, both globally and domestically, said Tim Toohey, Yarra Capital's head of macro and strategy. Su Ling Ong from the RBC Capital Markets said, the case for some tapering remains despite the current COVID-19 situation. The RBA must decide this week whether to renew its $100 billion quantitative easing bond purchase for the third time, set a lower target, or spread its buying over a longer time frame in response to improved growth and joblessness. Another option is to introduce a variable form of QE, the scope of which is dependent on the data. Its second monetary decision rests on whether its three-year target rate, which serves the purpose of linking the three-year borrowing rate to the 0.1% cash rate, is confined to the bond that expires in April 2024, or whether it will be rolled over to the next maturity in November 2024. If the RBA does not extend the yield target to November 2024, it is in effect signalling that interest rates will rise before Melbourne Cup Day in 2.5 years' time. Dr. Lowe faces quite a communication challenge on Tuesday, said Macquarie Bank economist Justin Fobo, given Greater Sydney will still be in lockdown until at least Friday. He's counting on yield targeting ending with the April 2024 bond and continuing QE of $5 billion a week, with an emphasis on a periodic review. The central bank has brought $156 billion of government, state and territory-issued bonds as at July the 1st. John Hawkins, senior lecturer at Canberra School of Politics, Economics and Society and NATSEM, the University of Canberra, wrote an article titled, Are Low Interest Rates Increasing Inequality? No, says the world's central bank. Philip Lowe, the governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, gets many letters and emails from retirees complaining they can't live on the interest from their savings when interest rates are so low. I read those letters. Many of them are very heartfelt and I feel very bad for the people who are in that situation, he told the House of Representatives Standing Committee on Economics in February. So I try and say, we understand. The second thing I do is to explain why we're in this situation. The idea that central banks have increased wealth inequality by keeping interest rates so low is so widespread that the Central Bank for Central Banks, the Bank for International Settlements, has addressed the issue in its 2021 annual economic report. Low interest rate means potential buyers can afford to borrow more. This pushes up the price of houses. Low interest rates also encourage spending rather than saving, which contributes more to company profits and thus more dividends to shareholders. This increases the value of shares. These factors benefit those who can afford to own property and shares, so the rich get richer. Some studies support this argument. The Netherlands Central Bank, for example, published a report in 2019 analysing almost a century of data for 12 advanced economies. It concluded low interest rates increase the income share of the top 1%. And RBA Research, published in February 2020, also found low interest rates increased housing wealth inequality by bumping up the value of more expensive homes. Lowe's deputy Guy DeBell acknowledged the distributional consequences of rising home prices in a speech in May, although said this wasn't the RBA's problem to fix. So, well, what is the view of the BIS, that global expert on monetary policy? It agrees the gap between the rich and the poor between countries has indeed widened since about 1980, and the COVID-19 recession has made things worse, but it concludes low interest rates are not the real culprit. No surprise there, I have to say. The BIS report instead emphasises the impact of technological progress and globalisation. Technological progress, particularly in information technology, has increased the productivity and incomes of the wealthy, such as top lawyers and tech company executives. It has done little for many low-income earners, such as aged care workers and restaurant staff. Globalisation refers to the increased international trade of goods and increasingly services. An example is corporations moving their call centres to countries where wages are lower. This has increased profitability for shareholders but eroded the bargaining power of lower skilled workers and small businesses. A central bank can only do so much to mitigate these factors. The main thing it can do is to help minimise unemployment, perhaps the most important driver of income inequality. Its tool to stimulate the economy is low interest rates. Low interest rate means consumers have less reason to save, so they spend more. Businesses are more likely to borrow to invest. All this helps create more jobs, so higher rates would likely mean higher unemployment, making income inequality worse. As Lowe explains to retirees, those people who have a job might be a child or your grandchild, and the society in the end, as a collective, is going to be better off if more people have jobs. Concerns about inequality may be one reason why central banks have altered their monetary policy framework. They're giving more priority to reducing unemployment and showing a willingness to tolerate temporarily higher inflation, which central banks control by raising interest rates. The US Federal Reserve, for example, has said that it will tolerate a period of inflation above its long-term target. The RBA has more subtly done something similar. Lowe has said Australia's central bank will not increase interest rates until actual inflation is back within the target range. Previously, it would have acted preemptively based on forecast inflation, given the lags between its actions and the impact on economic behaviour. Waiting does carry some risks that inflation will temporarily overshoot its target in 2024 or 2025, but with inflation having been below its target for an extended period, it is willing to accept this. Central banks may be able to help reduce inequality through some of their other roles, however. They can use their profile to advocate for policies that will help lower unemployment. Indeed, the Bank for International Settlement report notes the proportion of speeches by central bankers that mention inequality and the distributional consequences of monetary policy have risen significantly over the past decade. The RBA has argued strongly that expansionary fiscal policy, that is government spending, is important to keep the economy on track. Public investment will encourage rather than crowd out private investment. This is a rejection of those who argue for a rapid return to fiscal austerity. Central banks can also encourage governments to adopt policies that tend to reduce inequality over time. For example, in February, Lowe supported the wide consensus in the community for higher unemployment payments. Central banks can also reduce inequality by promoting financial inclusion, including for Indigenous citizens. They can help develop a more efficient payment system. All these sorts of measures help the poor. Again, the RBA has been acting on these fronts. Inequality of incomes is an important issue, but on balance, low interest rates are moderating rather than exacerbating it, said the article, to which I reply, no, it's a deflection. The fundamental reason why we have the inequality that we have is that interest rates are too low, people are borrowing too much, they're too leveraged, and of course too much is going into the property sector. The whole range of settings from central banks around the world have gone out of kilter, and now they're deflecting the conversation into things like lower unemployment and inflation targeting. The fact of the matter is, central banks have lost the plot, and of course the central banker's central banker would say nothing other than it's nothing to do with them. Finally, stakeholders have until the 30th of July to respond to a consultation on new rules that will allow consumers to share their open banking data with mortgage brokers. The Treasury has released for consultation new draft rules to amend the Consumer Data Right, or CDR, so that consumers can share their data with trusted professional advisors, including mortgage brokers, without those professionals needing to fall under the same regulatory obligations that currently apply to data recipients. Currently, the rules do not permit the disclosure of CDR data by an accredited data recipient, an ADR, such as a bank, to other parties that the consumer may wish to share their CDR data with. Indeed, in their initial format, the CDR rules outline strict parameters by which consumers' data can and cannot be shared, largely due to security and risk concerns. But following initial engagement with industry, it was noted that it was critical that a broad range of recipients should be able to engage in the consumer data rights scheme in order to achieve the competition and innovation objectives of the regime and for the CDR to support Australia's digital economy. As such, Treasury has released for consultations exposure draft amendments that empowers consumers to share their CDR data with certain classes of trusted advisors or to share limited insights obtained from CDR data. Trusted advisors must be one of the following: qualified accountants, people who are admitted to the legal profession, registered tax agents, BAS agents and tax financial advisors, financial counselling agencies, financial advisors or financial planners, and mortgage brokers. These professionals are all subject to existing professional or regulatory oversight, including fiduciary or other duties to act in the best interests of their clients. The amended rules mean that a CDR consumer can consent to an ADR, such as their bank, disclosing their CDR data to their nominated trusted advisor and enabling the lender to invite their customer to nominate one or more trusted advisors to share their data with. But the ADR cannot nominate the trusted advisor themselves. The process for this must accord with any consumer experience data standards, and the consents given must be voluntary, express, informed, and specific as to purpose, time limited, and easily withdrawn. Moreover, the ADR must take reasonable steps to confirm the person to whom the data is to be disclosed is a member of one of those approved trusted advisor categories. These might include checking a register or seeking confirmation from the individual themselves. The ADRs are also required to maintain records that detail and explain the disclosures of CDR data to trusted advisors, the trusted advisors to whom CDR data was disclosed, and the steps taken to confirm that a trusted advisor is a member of a class of trusted advisors. They must also report the number of consents received from CDR customers and for each category of trusted advisor, and the number of trusted advisors to whom the CDR data was disclosed. All data being sent to trusted advisors will need to be covered by the information security controls and must be encrypted in transit. Further, the consumer dashboard that relates to the request must indicate what CDR data was disclosed, when it was disclosed, and the name of the trusted advisor it was disclosed to. This would enable the CDR consumer to monitor where their data is being sent and, if necessary, withdraw their TA disclosure consent, the new amendments read. Standards will also be set to ensure that consumers are provided with adequate information to give informed consent when sharing their data. For example, information about the use of the data by the recipient will not be covered by a CDR regime, and the recipient may not have obligations under the Privacy Act of 1988. Other changes to the CDR rules aim to accelerate the benefits of the CDR for consumers by reducing barriers to participate in open banking and by allowing more Australians to leverage their data in common banking scenarios. These include introducing a sponsored tier of accreditation and a CDR representative model, allowing participants to share CDR insights with consumer consent for specific purposes, creating a single consent data sharing model for joint accounts, and interested parties are able to respond to this consultation until the 30th of July 2021. Now, I have to say, this feels to me a bit like a slippery slope. Having got step one of the data sharing through open banking underway, they're now opening the aperture much further. And the question is, will the technological solutions, and more importantly, will consumers understand precisely the way this is going to work? I can see this getting very complicated very quickly. And the danger is, of course, that consumers share their information with entities that probably shouldn't be shared with. And I think that the protections, as outlined, are very weak. So I think I'll be making a submission to the Treasury suggesting they should rethink this further development of open banking, which, by the way, I intuitively support because I think more competition is good. But it must be informed consent, and it must be made simple and straightforward for consumers. And frankly, based on the submission from Treasury, this ain't straightforward. Now, if you're buying your home in Sydney's contentious market, you don't need to stand alone. This is the time you need to have Edwin Almeida from Ribbon Property Consultants standing alongside you. Buying a property is both challenging and adversarial. The vendor has a professional on their side. Emotions run high, price discovery and price transparency are hard to find, and then there's the wasted time and financial investments that you make. Edwin understands your needs, so why not engage a licensed professional to stand alongside you? With RPC, you know you have experience, knowledge, and master negotiators looking after your best interests. So shoot Ribbon an email at info@ribbonproperty.com.au. And if you use the promo code DFAWTW/Martin, you can get a 10% discount offer. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.